Welcome to the Ferris Love Shrine podcast, where we share spiritual and practical ideas for how to live family life with a beautiful, self-sacrificing love. In this episode, we're talking with Noelle Maring, author of Awake Not Woke and co-author of Theology of Home. Welcome, Noelle.
Thanks for having me. Hi, Katie.
Yeah, we're excited to have a discussion and talk a little bit more about your book, your most recent book, Awake Not Woke. So why don't we just jump in, and why don't you tell us just a little bit about the book itself and kind of what inspired you to write it?
Sure. So the book is published with Tan Books. It came out in 2021. I actually signed contracts for it in early 2020 prior to COVID and all of the craziness of that year. So it's kind of funny to be writing it while all that was going on, or I guess lend a certain urgency to the project. The book is meant to be accessible to anyone. I did not write it at an extremely high academic level, and I am not an extremely high academic, so that made sense. I wanted to write it to people like myself who was just wrestling with this movement and trying to understand what exactly animated it what the Christian response should be to it. I'd been writing about the woke movement since about 2018, just articles mostly starting then, from looking at it from different angles. And it's just been an interesting phenomenon to me on multiple levels. And I think I really just wanted to kind of get some clarity, because it seemed that there was a lot of confusion surrounding it. And I wanted to understand what was, you know, the philosophy behind it, because it seemed to me like they were not, this movement, it was not exactly limiting itself to politics. It was speaking to things that touch on the nature of the human person, where our fulfillment lies, what the definition of a human person is, both to male and female, but also just more generally, the importance of family, or the lack of importance of family, and these all seemed like things that were deeply they're questions that every human being has. And I thought, if we're not addressing these adequately, then they're going to be defaulting to an political ideology that I don't think is answering them in a way that is consistent with the faith. And so that was interesting to me, and I really wrote the book with that in mind.
Mm-hmm. I love that. So for those who are kind of new to the idea of the woke movement, or perhaps have heard of it, but just are like, I can't really define that or describe that. Like, how do you kind of talk about it, and how would you define it?
Yeah, no, I think the woke movement is maybe the most neutral way to define it, is that it's a movement that is trying to help us become alert and attuned to the various layers of oppression in society, generally surrounding the sort of the hot button issues, like gender, sexuality, transgenderism, race. And I think it's ostensibly a movement oriented around justice. But when you understand what the principles are behind it, it really is far a pretty unjust movement. I think it's a true to type ideology, in the sense that it takes things that are partially true and then totalizes them. And in that totalization, it turns itself into a lie. But it's manipulative in a certain way, in that it positions itself as the only right application of justice in, in the world. So that if we want to be on the right side of fighting racism, or fighting, oppression, or walking with the marginalized, or all of the things that I think as Christians we want to be on the right side of, then it says, this is the only way that you can do it. And I think it becomes rather totalitarian in that way, and kind of militant. And I think a lot of people sort of sense that it's going beyond its reach in that way, and but are not exactly sure how to understand that, how to analyze it, and how to respond to it.
Sure. Yeah, it's true. I'm sure a lot of people kind of feel like this doesn't feel exactly right, but exactly how to address that is tricky for them, for sure. So what kind of tips would you have when it comes to kind of navigating this woke movement for parents today? Like, what should they do? How do they even begin to kind of look at this and address it?
Yeah, no, it's a great question. I mean, I think that there's two kind of impulses that people can have. That one, to sort of just ignore it, just to say, this is too controversial and it's going to cause division. I don't want to get into the weeds in this movement because people believe so strongly in it. And so, I don't want to put myself out on the limb, and perhaps that will be compromising, my Christian witness too, if I enter into something controversial. And I think that not everyone is meant to engage in the discussion to the same level, the same way. We have to be prudential about how we talk about these things and whether or not we need to. They certainly should not be brought into every dinner discussion. But I think it's important to understand them. So the two errors, I think, are one, on one side, I think we can kind of ignore it and try to sweep it under the rug too much. And on the other side, I think we can sort of become a mirror image of, you know, exactly the type of thing we're trying to defeat, where we see this becoming too political, things becoming too political and too militant. You know, we can do that on the flip side, where we're just kind of, we're becoming absorbed in ideology, or we're becoming overly political, and not seeing the fullness of reality. And I think as Christians, we're really supposed to think, you know, with the fullness of truth, you know, philosophical truths, supernatural truth, the truth about the human person, and also understanding the political realities at hand. So, and that kind of desire to understand things that are, you know, from that full awareness of truth, with that full freedom that truth brings, also gives us, you know, eyes of mercy, I think, you know, it tells us, you know, that the person is not our, another, the person across the table who I might be, you know, on the other side politically, is not really my enemy. These are a brother or sister in Christ, and that, you know, my job is to treat them with dignity and respecting, you know, their soul and their dignity and their ability to kind of wrestle and think and, come to their own conclusions. So those are, I think, two extremes. And what I would advise, I think, is the maybe the healthiest way is just to first try to understand it. I think this is something that is affecting people deeply and our society deeply. And so there's, I think, somewhat of a duty, therefore, to kind of really try to understand it, try to understand this thing that is kind of taking over so many people's minds and imaginations and our institutions. And that's really what I'm hopeful that the book can do, is to try to lend some clarity to this movement. And once we can kind of gain clarity, I think we'll have more confidence to engage when we should engage and not feel that we're ill-equipped to have a discussion that feels complicated and fraught and, you know, laden with emotional and kind of pitfalls that we don't want to walk into. You know, because there ultimately, I find it to be an ideology that is easier to defeat than I think it seems like. And so because of that, because I don't think that there's a whole rich depth of, you know, philosophical heft behind it, I think that we can feel that can give us confidence too, that this is something that we can, when called upon, really combat and take on, out of justice for our society, I think.
Sure. That makes sense. I'm curious why you say, or you feel that it's kind of easier to defeat this than someone might think. Cause I could imagine someone listening to this, or even myself, like listening and being like, I don't know, like it's everywhere. It seems like it's a huge monster to be able to defeat. So why do you say that?
Yeah, no, I mean, there's two different ways I can answer that. You know, one way I think it is hard to defeat because of the way that it really takes hold of someone. You know, it almost, I think it almost becomes like its own type of religion, where people cling to it with sort of a zealotry that I think is sort of characteristic of a religion that's not really based on, you know, on real rational principles, you know, sort of like an irrational kind of fundamentalist type of religion. So in that way, I think it can be very difficult. But in the other way, I say that because it's not really coherent. It kind of, it kind of eats itself. And we see this happening, for example, in the way that the transgender movement is now battling the feminists. You know, there's an absurdity, you know, that it's putting forward, with regard to what it is to be a woman, what it is to be a man, where, you know, we really are erasing the idea of what women are. And you know, there are other similar claims that I think are similarly absurd. For example, they'll say things like 2 + 2 could equal 5. You know, that there's that if in someone's lived experience, it might equal 5. And so those things, I think, point to a real kind of Achilles heel of the movement that is really not a movement based on truth. It's based on power, oriented towards power and defeating, you know, injustice and in reversing power structures. And I think the human person longs for things that are true. Our minds are oriented towards things that are true. We're naturally seeking that. And so when this movement comes with such obvious kind of absurdities, I think that there's a way in which that's naturally kind of repulsive to people in their, you know, intellectually a bit repulsive. And I think the more that this is sort of accelerating, where we're seeing those sort of claims made, you know, more brazenly, the more I think it's really kind of turning more people away than it is galvanizing supporters.
Oh, sure. That makes sense. That makes total sense. So, you know, from all your research, what are some of these tactics that you see the woke movement kind of using to get their message out and to kind of convince you that, you know, 2 + 2 could equal 5 or whatever it happens to be?
Yeah. Well, there's a couple of different ways that we can look at it. For mm-hmm. one thing, there's been, as the saying goes, a long march through the institutions. So they're truly, they've been playing a long game for far longer than we've realized. It's now coming to the surface, but there really has been an effort to take hold of the academy from not just mm-hmm. the university, but also K-12. There's mm-hmm. been a long push to get art and media to all be or primarily be surrounding narratives of oppression to the point where, you know, we almost see oppression everywhere because it's in so mm-hmm. deeply in our narratives that we're presented with in television, movies, stories. Mm-hmm. So I think it's been really effective in getting hold of institutions, also media, politics, journalism, certainly. Mm-hmm. So that's been one tactic just to gain power. There are a couple other tactics. One that I think is really effective, particularly with Catholics or Christians, is, or just really anyone of goodwill, is that appeal to your compassion. That if mm-hmm. you are, you know, that they'll present a story of someone suffering, and that story of suffering is going to, you know, be compelling to anyone who has empathy. Mm-hmm. So they use narratives of suffering a lot in order to kind of absorb you into an ideology. And I think that that's, it's manipulative in a particular way, obviously, but it's also effective. You know, it really is effective. And at the same time, there's a manipulation of language that happens. So mm-hmm. for example, Ibram X. Kendi wrote a book called How to Be an Anti-Racist. Mm-hmm. And on the face of it, being anti-racist is a true and good statement. Who doesn't want to be an anti-racist? Sure. Or, you know, when the statement Black Lives Matter, that is a true and good statement. Black lives do matter, obviously. Mm-hmm. But the problem is that they're saying far more than just what the statement sounds like on the surface. But I think most normal people will translate into something that is, you know, just and something that is sensible, and don't, without reading the literature, don't have any sense that there's actually a whole host of really deeply unjust principles that are embedded in those phrases. And mm-hmm. you have to do your anti-racism just in a very particular way. It's not just to oppose racism. It's far more than that. It's to actually become an mm-hmm. ideologue in a very particular way. Mm-hmm. And the injustice, I think, goes far beyond, you know, even just sort of a reverse racism. It actually, I think, is blatantly racist. You know, those other claims sure. such as politeness is a white virtue or being on time mm-hmm. is a white virtue. You know, this is Reddit really is doing is stealing the possibility of virtue from everyone because it's saying, mm-hmm. you know, that these things are not actually available to human persons, that they're not good things to strive for, to be hard worker, to be, you know, on time, to be punctual, to be kind, to be polite. These are actually just functions of a cultural, you know, milieu that is predicated on your skin color. You know, so that mm-hmm. what that really does is it robs the human person of that sort of moral agency that virtue really demands that we acknowledge and exercise.
That makes sense. Wow. It's crazy. What, you know, you mentioned earlier education and how that's one of the like major tactics. And I can imagine, right, there are parents who, you know, have college children or recent graduates who kind of have fallen into this ideology, or, you know, family dinner tables, a debate now with them. So what advice would you have for, you know, these families or these parents as they dialogue about some of these things that are more, they become much more heated now?
Yeah. Yeah, no, it's so hard. And that's been one of the hardest things after the writing the book, is that I hear from parents so often that their kids went to college and came back and now kind of disdain everything that they raised them to believe, and sort of disdain them too, just think that they are kind of dinosaurs who are not with it. And you know, and feel that they are kind of there to now teach them the right way to think, you know. You know, the first thing obviously is always going to be to pray. You know, I think that is where our greatest power lies and our greatest ability to affect, especially adult children, because the relationship certainly shifts when your kids are adults. It's, you're no longer able to control what their morning is or their afternoon is or what time they come home. Or obviously, there's all mm-hmm. these obvious ways that we lose control, but also the relationship really is rightfully supposed to shift, where we know our opinion is not, when uninvited, is not necessarily always to be given, you know, that we're supposed to respect their freedom and their ability to to, you know, be navigating their own way through the world. And in that respect, we kind of position ourselves to become the type of people that they will actually choose to come back to and seek advice from and input from. So I think that there's a really delicate way in which we have to be navigating that relationship, and particularly when there's such deep disagreement. So I think that it obviously takes a whole host of prayer, but then also prudence, right? Like, we have to know when to speak, when not to speak, and also to know that there is, you know, that this is normal, that they might have gotten absorbed in it. I mean, not normal in the sense of, you know, nothing to worry about, but normal in the sense that it's very easy to, when you go off to a college, to fold into all of this stuff. So, you know, I would ask questions. I think questions are always a good way. You know, how does that work with, you know, how does what you're saying here fit with what we, you know, you believe here? And are these things consistent? And how does that, you know, how does that play out in your mind? Try to get them to think more deeply about it. And in asking them and inviting them to think more deeply, you know, there's a real opportunity there that they can start to poke holes in it themselves. And it might not happen, you know, in one conversation, it probably won't. But the hope is that it'll plant a seed, you know, and then I always think that, then, you know, a happy, you know, well-formed family life from their, you know, their history, their childhood, it has such a pull on an adult child, even, you know, when they've gone far away, moved, or maybe even seemingly gone off the reservation, they still know where the reservation is. they know, and they remember it fondly. And so I would trust in that too, trust in that formation and that, you know, affection that was established in their youth.
Sure. That makes perfect sense. You talk in your book a little bit, but I'd love for you to explain a little bit more, tell our listeners kind of why the corruption of our children is kind of a logical outgrowth of these woke principles. Can you just, you know, give us a nutshell explanation of that from the book?
Sure. Yeah. No, it's one of the more disturbing but fascinating things that I researched is, so the idea is that the woke movement is finds our liberation by fighting oppression in two ways. The oppression that comes from us from groups outside of ourselves, power structures in society, but also a liberation from our own internalized kind of taught desire to repress ourselves. And, you know, by conforming ourselves to kind of traditional norms of sexuality and chastity and all these things, that those things are actually oppressing us as well. And so part of our liberation is we find our freedom in transgressing the moral law. And in that transgression, we are liberated from it. So that second sort of liberation really starts to imply that there is innocence in this world is actually a perpetuation, is a type of dominance. It perpetuates a norm. So, for example, you know, a lot of people have been wondering why what is this phenomenon with transgender story hours or drag queen story hour? And I think it really makes perfect sense according to the ideology. You know, it's ostensibly, it's you know, to keep kids from becoming bullies. Like, that's what one of the reasons they'll give. You know, we want kids to be exposed to alternative lifestyles so that they won't make fun of them. The second reason they'll say is, you know, that there might be a child who is actually, you know, pulled in this direction, and by presenting them this alternative lifestyle, they can, you know, see a door, the way they can walk through, and that can help them free themselves. But the third reason, the more sinister reason, is I think that the child's innocence of those alternative lifestyles allows them to grow up and walk through the world thinking that there is a default way of being, that men are men and that women are women and that traditional marriage is a norm, and that, you know, then those two people have babies and then those babies grow up and, you know, repeat that. And insofar as they think that that's the default way of being, it's giving power to that kind of traditional family life. And that is really has to be, they have to be disabused of their innocence of alternative lifestyles in order to disrupt and disturb kind of the power structure of the family. That even the family life is a type of privilege. And by privilege, I mean that in a Marxist way, kind of like white privilege or male privilege, that privilege, according to the ideology, actually means that you've got power and illicit power. Mm-hmm. That even the family is considered to be an illicit power structure that is oppressing alternative forms of being.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it's crazy. How do you, like, suggest parents kind of protect their children from these kinds of things. Exactly. Like, you might not even know. You might go to your local library and there's the drag book reading of whatever. And so, like, suggestions or tips for parents kind of protecting, especially their young children, from kind of falling into this.
Yeah, no, it's such a hard and big topic because, you know, obviously, you know, we're not called to be in a defensive crouch from the world, you know, terrified of walking out the door. And I always say, you know, one of the things about safety in the home is that it's far more about what we're building up in the home than it is about what we're keeping out. So, you know, I think first and foremost, we have to be forming our homes to be, you know, those bright, cheerful, happy homes and full of love and full of positive things, that we are showing them a vision of, you know, the good of life, the good of the family, pointing them towards our Lord and our Lady. But also helping them develop their own natural skills, abilities, you know, the talents. The more that kids are kind of lit from within in something that they can, you know, develop in themselves and work towards, you know, then the more that they'll be kind of led towards human virtue, you know, even in that natural way, that they're pulled to kind of developing themselves and pulled to working at something for the sake of something. But I also, you know, obviously we do have to keep things out as well. So I think we have to be really careful about media. You know, there's just so much out there that is really, really sinister, I think, on both online and in shows. So I don't think we can be complacent in that way. I think we also have to be really intentional about what's happening in the schools that we're sending to our kids. You know, I think for a long time we thought that you know, we could just trust what was happening. I think that the last couple of years have shown us that that's not true anymore. And then perhaps it hadn't been true for quite a while, but for, you know, for various reasons, we've become more aware of it. I think it's super important for kids to have support that are from peer groups. So the more they can be either in a school where the families are mutually, you know, like-minded, or if you don't have that, you know, to get them involved in activities. You know, that's why I love having the girls go to camp in the summer and the boys go to camp, or they go down to have, you know, we have girls clubs and all of these things. I think all of that really feeds kind of a need for peer support that can really help sustain them when they sort of realize pretty quickly that they're actually living quite a countercultural lifestyle. You know, I think delaying smartphones as long as humanly possible is a, you know, in my opinion, that's super important. You know, I would even till 17 or 18 or so. I think we tend to do it way too soon, and it's much harder to change course once we've unleashed that phone into a kid's hands than it is to just not do it at all. So they get addicted very quickly. And if we do, you know, once we do give it to them, you know, having really good positive rules that we set an example with first and foremost, that we're not on our phones all the time, that we are being with each other, we're being human with each other and entering into relationship with one another, not just staring into a device all day.
Sure. Makes total sense. I'm curious if you know, for parents who are listening to this and feeling really overwhelmed now and kind of stressed out by like the woke movement and this around their kids and all this, like, do you see hope? Do you see, like, how do you see the future kind of moving when you look at kind of this and all the research that you've done?
Yeah. You know, I see two different paths. You know, I see that there could be very hard times ahead. You know, there could even be persecution and all sorts of things, increasing censorship, increasing persecutions of the faith and infringements on religious liberty. So I certainly see that that's very possible. I also see that we could, you know, there's a real awakening happening. You know, I think that we saw that with the parent school board meetings. You know, a lot of those parents were not even religious or, you know, conservative. There were progressive parents who were just found it repugnant that their kids were being indoctrinated into like a collectivist mindset and, you know, radical gender ideology at such young ages. So I think the more we could band together with, you know, like-minded people in that way and who want to resist this and want to find creative and practical ways to push back on it, that has real power. I think certain companies that have been, you know, gone too far woke, there's been a real resistance against them that's hit them in their pocketbooks and has been effective. So those things give me a lot of hope. And of course, you know, this is all a trust in God's providence. And if, you know, if he wants us to suffer, well, we'll suffer, but we'll do so, you know, with him by our side, knowing that, that is far more powerful than any human ideology, you know, or, you know, I actually think it's a sort of a diabolical ideology, but that our Lord and our Lady are not going to cast us aside, that they will be walking with us every step of the way. And, you know, we are people of hope. So despair and discouragement actually are total waste of time when we think about it. And they don't belong in our minds or imaginations.
I love that. All right, Noelle, before we sign off, any last words of wisdom, any last tidbits you'd like to share with our listeners?
Yeah, I think I would just say that, you know, I think that we should and could have a lot of courage as we are navigating our way through this. I think that there is a way in which it is an emperor's new clothes type of situation, you know, that there really is not a lot of there, and that, you know, it feels like it's so impenetrable and also so powerful at this time. Mm-hmm. But I think that we can feel like a real confidence that it's far more defeatable than we think. And I know I said that earlier, mm-hmm. but I really truly do think that, but it's going to take courage. And I think that, you know, mm-hmm. that we can teach our kids to be people of courage, and we can model it for them and know and trust that, you know, the more that we are, you know, really standing up in ways that can feel a little bit scary, that our Lord's by our side, and that sort of courage is exactly what he asks us of us, that if any persecution that we experience in his name, you know, we don't go looking for it, but if we're presented with it, then, you know, we can feel a real joy in that too, you know, that we're following his will. So yeah, I would really want to encourage people that they can get a hold of this, you know, wrap their minds around it, get clarity, and then proceed with courage and confidence.
All right. That's great. That's a perfect way to end this on courage. I think that's awesome. If people want to find you, find your book, where can they kind of do that?
Sure. So I all of my personal publications are on my website, noellemaring.com. I also am co-editor of theologyofhome.com, and we have a free subscription there. We encourage people with a daily email full of ways to organize your home, or, you know, fun things like recipes, but also spiritual fruit and food, and a little bit of, you know, news and that. And our books, our Theology of Home books, and also Wake Not Woke, are sold on theologyofhome.com or anywhere you buy books.
Great. Yep. And I know Tan has the audiobook, the ebook, and the physical book. So whichever way you like listening to books or reading books, you can get a Wake Not Woke that way for sure. Well, Noelle, thank you so much for this conversation. This was excellent. Hopefully people got a lot out of it as well.
Thanks. It was great to be with you.
Yeah. Thanks for listening to this episode of the Ferris Love Shrine podcast. If you enjoyed it, we'd love for you to visit us at ferrislovshrine.org and share the podcast with others.